we as a class would have the opportunity to go out to dinner together and enjoy ourselves was not bad. As time went on, and I became very familiar with the lesson material, I felt a great sense of accomplishment. Go figure. I could now understand and was able to participate in discussions that were related to great literature. I understood because I had to actually read it, not because I had seen one or two movies. Test day came. I could feel knots in my stomach on my way to class. I passed the test with flying colors, and so did everyone else. This only made the prize even sweeter, because I had worked very hard and enjoyed myself doing it. However, something ended up raining on my parade. The day before our long-awaited field trip, another teacher told me and a friend in my class that we were not going to be able to go unless we dressed in slacks and a tie and not like gangsters. Gangsters? Since when do gangsters wear guess? Shirts with Levi pants at the waist. I always thought gangsters like to dress in pants 3 times their actual waist size with white t-shirts. Maybe he felt this way because of my race. I didn't know, and I was confused. Funny that he was creating rules of his own. After all, he was only tagging along as a chaperone. He shouldn't have been pushing his weight around. No problem, we thought. Even though neither one of us owned a tie, we were going to dress our best without one. The next day, as my friend and I stood in line to board the bus, we were asked to step out of the line and let others aboard. We were actually being denied the right to participate in the field trip because we were not wearing ties by that same teacher that had talked to us a day earlier. I was in complete shock. I had worked so hard to get to the awaited moment only to be told that I could not participate because of my appearance. Confused and disappointed, my friend and I went home. The next day was very hard, as everyone asked why I didn't attend a field trip. Actually, what really bothered me was how everyone was bragging about how fun it was. A little while after the incident, I met with Ms. Gruel and the other teacher who prevented me from participating in the event. Ms. G put up a hell of a fight. Apparently, she felt that I had the right to go too, just like everyone else, and that I was wrongfully discriminated against because of the way I was dressed. Even though the teacher eventually apologized to me for this blatant discrimination, I forgave him, but didn't forget. To think that I was denied something because of the fact that I was not wearing a tie, but was still following the dress code, disgusts me. From now on, I will walk with my head in the clouds and dream of when people will stop judging books by their cover.
Diary 30. Dear Diary, 4 eyes, blind as a bat, or worse yet, Coke bottle bitch, were the mean comments I heard all through my childhood. I would come home from elementary and middle school in tears every day because my classmates or even strangers would harass me. I even begged my mother to let me change schools because people made fun of me too much. Their ruthless comments shaped my personality and turned me into a shy, insecure, quiet girl. I was always alone because I was afraid of making friends and then finding out that they made fun of me behind my back. Just recently, I was sitting in my science class when I heard the girls sitting next to me making rude comments about my bad eyesight. I am very sensitive when it comes to my eyesight, and somehow she sensed it. I tried to ignore her, but she started writing on my jacket. I got up and I said, "You know what? I'm fucking tired of this." I couldn't believe I said that because I used to just brush off what people said. She said, "Shut up, you blind bitch." When I heard her call me that name, I lost it. I slapped her. It was as if she represented all the kids throughout the years who had made fun of me. All the anger that had built up in my heart throughout my childhood years was released at that moment. I was so furious that I blacked out, literally. My mind went blank. My science teacher separated us, and I was shaking uncontrollably. I don't know what happened to me next. When I told Ms. G about the fight, she told me about one of her students named Sherrod, who was teased because he had big lips. She said she found a mean drawing of his lips and it made her lose her cool. After yelling and screaming at the class, she said the incident woke her up and made her become a better teacher. Maybe this incident could make me a better person, too. Diary 31. Dear Diary, the bell rang and everybody walked into class. All the desks were up against the wall. There was a table full of plastic champagne glasses and bottles of apple cider all around the room. I thought, what the hell is going on? Are we having a party? I saw Miss Gruel waving her arms around like a crazy lady, but no one was reacting to her caffeine high. We all knew the effect caffeine had on Miss Gruel. Throughout the class period, things began to change drastically. Miss Gruel stood on the desk and began to talk about change. I thought, what is this lady trying to do? What does she mean by change? Then people started crying. I thought to myself, why is everyone crying? I didn't understand. Miss Gruel passed out books and bags from Barnes & Noble. When I saw the look on people's faces, I felt like jumping up for joy. I wanted to start reading them at that very moment. I was so occupied with one of my new books that I missed the whole idea of what we were supposed to do with them. The book had never been opened, and the pages smelled like a new car. I started reading Night by Elie Wiesel, and I can't wait to get started on The Wave by Todd Strasser, Anne Frank's Diary, and last but not least, Zlata's Diary. At first, I thought we were going to have to do a lot of book reports. Then she told us about the Readathon for Tolerance. What the heck is Ms. Gruel talking about? She said we'd have fun because the stories are about kids in similar situations. We were all teenagers who were going through a difficult time in our lives. Some of us succeed and others don't. That is just how it is, and all I wanted to do was be one of the people who make it. I've always been one of the kids that needed to change. I can't even try to deny it. My mom is no help because I can't do anything wrong in her eyes. I am mommy's little girl, no matter how badly I'm doing in school or what type of drugs I've tried. My dad is just the opposite. He's never cared about how bad I'm doing, or how good for that matter. Everyone changes as they get older, no matter if it's good or bad. So I guess I was offered an opportunity that not many people have. I got a second chance to change my life for the better. I thank God that He sent an angel to give me that chance to change. I was always known as the person that was going to be a druggie or get pregnant before I turned 14 and drop out. Now I have the chance to prove them wrong.
Diary 32. Dear Diary, a year has passed since two of my friends died. Man, everyone respected those two. Those guys were the most loved cholos of the barrio. That's how I wanted to be when I grew up. All I wanted to do was impress them. While I was in school one day, they were killed while trying to commit a robbery. To think I could have been with them. After this incident, I started to see life from a whole new perspective. I had been taking the wrong path all along. Now my best friend and I were the oldest cholos in the barrio. It was pitiful that all the older guys were either 6 feet under or living behind bars. As the weeks went by, I slowly changed my ways. I didn't want the younger ones to look up to me when I was a loser. I had done so much to hurt my community, and now it was time to do something to help it. Now the young ones are looking up to me as a role model, so I try my hardest to give a straight image on how things should be and make them see right from wrong. My neighbors adore me. I have a warm feeling deep down inside, as if I am the chosen one in the barrio. But it hurts me to know that it took the lives of two dear friends for me to turn my life around. I guess it's never too late to change in life. If I did it, others should be able to as well. It really all depends on how badly one wants to change. I'm lucky to have another opportunity at a clean start. It's just too bad the two cholos were never given the same opportunity.
Diary 33. Dear Diary, you can't go against your own people, your own blood. Those words kept ringing in my mind as I walked down the courtroom aisle to sit in a cold, empty chair next to the judge. I kept telling myself, get your shit together. You don't want to contradict yourself on the witness stand. Your homie's future lies in your hands. I was convinced that I had to lie to protect my own, the way I was always taught to do. As I walked through the courtroom, I kept my eyes focused straight ahead, afraid to make eye contact with anyone. It was so quiet that the only things I could hear were the steps I took walking across the marble floor and my heart. As I sat in the chair, I felt as if I was exposed to different eyes. Those eyes, in some strange way, were touching a part of me that was deep inside. Everyone was waiting for my reaction. When I sat down, I noticed the courtroom was divided. On one side, there was my family and my friends. Most of them are from one of the most notorious gangs in California. They had all come because they were worried about what the other side might do to me after the verdict. Even though they were there to protect me, I didn't feel safe. I guess it was because they couldn't protect me from the one thing I was actually afraid of, the guilt I had inside. Because all I had to do was look in the eyes of my people for them to reassure me that I had no choice but to take care of my own. I had to protect Paco, no matter what went down. We all knew that no matter what, I wasn't going to rat on my homeboy. He would give his life for me without hesitation, the same way I would give mine for his. All I had to do was sit there and lie about what had happened that night. The night when Paco was only proving once again that he would do anything for his main girl. He was only protecting me and sending out a warning not to mess with me again. On the other side of the courtroom were the family members of the guy who was being falsely accused of murder. Those people, his family, and his friends, of course, were looking at me with rage. I knew why, but I didn't care. I wasn't afraid of them. They were our rivals, and they had it coming. They had already killed one of our friends, and they had jumped me a couple of weeks before. Then one person on his side caught my eye. Her look wasn't filled with rage. There was strength and sadness, which made it painfully familiar. She looked at me, tears rolling down her cheeks, and hugged the little girl on her lap. When I saw her tears, a little voice inside of me whispered very quietly, "Doesn't she remind you of someone you love more than anyone else in the world?" I tried to ignore the little voice, but then the voice spoke louder. It told me that this woman was my mother, and that little girl was me. I couldn't help but stare back, imagining how life would be for that little girl without her father. I pictured her waiting for her father to come home, knowing he wasn't. I pictured her visiting him and not being able to touch him because of an unbreakable window. And I imagined her wanting to unlock his cage, knowing she couldn't. The same memories I have of my father in prison. The woman looked at me again, and I could see that she was suffering the same way my mother suffered when my dad and brother went to prison. I wondered how they could be so different. My mother is Mexican, and this woman is black. Yet the emotions that made them cry came from a heart that was tearing apart the same way. Throughout my life, I've always heard the same thing. You can't go against your own people, your own blood. It got so engraved in my head that even as I sat on the witness stand, I kept thinking of those same words. You can't go against your own. Yet my so-called familia, my so-called people, had put me in the worst position of my life. My feelings were starting to change. I began to have second thoughts. I was convinced that I was going to lie. Before I entered the courtroom, before I saw the woman, before I saw the little girl. But now I wasn't so sure. Suddenly his lawyer interrupted my thoughts by busting out with questions. Who shot the guy? Then I looked at my friend. He was just staring at me with a smug look on his face. He wasn't worried about anything, even though he was guilty. Even though he knew I had witnessed everything. When he shot the guy, he looked at me and said, "This is for you." He knew I was gonna lie. He knew that I always had his back before, so I had no reason to turn on him now. I turned to look at him, and my eyes started getting watery. He was surprised, as if it wasn't a big deal, but this time it was a big deal. Then I glanced at my mom. She shook her head, and it was as if she knew that I wanted to say the truth. I never told her what actually happened that night, but she knew my friend had done it. When she had asked me what I was going to say, I told her, "I'm going to protect my own. You know how it is. You have to know. You and every other person in my family taught me about my own. I know how it is, but why does it always have to be that way?" She never spoke to me that way before. After all, my father is in prison, and most of my family is in a gang. I always figured that my mom accepted how things were. That's just the way things go when you're in a gang. Then she asked me, "How does it feel to be sending an innocent person to prison? You probably feel like that man that sent your father to prison, knowing he was innocent. You know, he was only protecting his own, too." And for the first time in my life, the image of my mother made me believe that I could change the way things were. Because at that moment, I locked eyes with Paco and said, "Paco did it. Paco shot the guy." Diary 34. Dear Diary, you're going to be so disappointed in me. Actually, I'm more disappointed in myself for the way I'm tricking people into believing that I'm something I'm not. Since I've been in Miss Gruel's class, everyone thinks I am Little Miss Goody Goody. It never fails. She always uses me as the good example. I'm seen as the kind of student that is quiet, has good grades, and is the teacher's pet. The strange thing is that while everyone around me is changing because of our toast for change, I seem to be the only one who's not going anywhere. It's hard for me because I have a lot of people who always tell me that I am smart and that I seem to have it all together, and they sometimes wish they were like me. If they only knew that on the inside, I'm just barely keeping it together. I'm living a lie. I'm struggling with a deep secret. Being a closet drinker. I walk around with my water bottle, pretending to be better than what I am. Deep down inside, it hurts me that I can't bring myself to tell anyone about my problem. I do want to change, but it's so hard. It's so hard for me to change because I fear that people will not like the sober me. I've been doing it for so long. It's just a daily routine, like getting up in the morning, going to the bathroom, and brushing your teeth. I can't keep on hiding the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I'm hiding it from my mom, Ms. G, and all of my friends. I know I need help, but how do I go about getting it? It has got to be hereditary because not only do I have this problem, but my grandfather, my dad, and his mom had this problem also. I guess I was going to end up with it myself sooner or later. Let me tell you about my day. I woke up craving orange juice with a little hint of vodka. Guess what I did? As usual, I went to my secret stash and poured my favorite drink, vodka and orange juice. I started wondering, how am I going to achieve anything in life if I can't even start the day without alcohol? Of course, my mom was already at work, so I walked out the door with my water bottle filled with OJ and vodka and went to school like it was an everyday thing. The thing that really got me was when I got to school, no one, I mean not even Miss G or even my best friend, had any idea that I was drunk. I talked to my friends and teachers and they didn't know. You know why? Because I have a trick. I stop off at the donut shop and buy a pack of gum after I get off the bus. Smart, huh? During PE, I almost drowned because my legs gave out on me while I was in the pool. Everyone thought it was because I was feeling fatigued. but I knew it was because I was drunk. At lunch, I could hardly stand. I ran to the bathroom and puked all over the stall. I tried to convince myself that it was because of the flu or something. By dinner time, I was back to the way people always saw me, sweet, smart, and innocent. My drinking never really bothered me before we started reading all these books about people changing and wanting to make a difference. It makes me feel like such a hypocrite. The story that sticks with me the most is how the Nazis deliberately hurt innocent people like Anne Frank. And in my case, I'm the one who's hurting myself. I'm the one choosing to hide. Unfortunately, Anne Frank was never free. It makes me wonder if I'll ever be. Diary 35. Dear Diary, tonight I just finished one of the books for our readathon called The Wave. This story is about a school experiment that shows how peer pressure can get out of hand. One of the main characters was a guy by the name of Robert Billing. He pressured and bullied other teenagers into acting like modern-day Nazis. The teenagers were like sheep blindly following a leader. After reading this book, I realized how teens are very gullible, getting tricked into doing things against their will because they want to fit in and be popular. That must be why Hitler preyed on children. It's amazing how he controlled thousands of teenagers called the brown shirts. I can't believe how peer pressure can take charge of a person's life and change who they are. I know that stories like this are true because I've experienced peer pressure myself. I wanted to hang out with the so-called cool crowd so badly that I was talked into doing things I knew were wrong. I came to school one time and found my usual friends, and someone was telling the others about how they just got away with shoplifting. I wondered how they did it without getting caught. I listened to them because I never had any stories to tell about stealing. They always said that I'm such a goody two-shoes. On this particular day, I felt like I should prove them wrong. Later that night, my family and I went shopping, and that's when my nightmare started. I jacked some makeup and thought to myself as I slowly walked toward the door, I can just walk out that door. It will all be over. Please don't let anyone see me. Yes, I'm out the door. I did it. I got away, I thought, as I passed the two automatic doors. Excuse me, miss. I'm a security officer here. Can you please step inside the store with me? We have evidence that you took some makeup. My parents froze in their steps. Shit. I got caught. I can't believe this. All the blood drained from my face. My parents were shocked. All they could do was stare at me in disbelief. My dad looked like he was going to slap me. My mom looked like she could kill me. All they said was, "What a disgrace! How can you do this to us? Do you know how humiliating this is?" I could feel my body shaking. I had never done anything like this in my entire life. I knew my parents were going to kill me. This can't be happening. It's just a dream. Just a dream. Wake up. Hurry. I kept telling myself as I stepped back into the store. They took me to a small, weird room in the corner. It might have been a well-lit room, but it felt cold and dark. They told me to have a seat while my parents stood by the door glaring down at me. They told me to pull out the makeup I had put in my pocket. They totaled up the cost, which came up to $15. Then they brought out the wrappers that I had tried to hide between other things in the store. They had also taken snapshots of me. I felt like a big-time criminal. As they were taking the pictures, they told me to lighten up for the camera. Why the hell were they telling me this when I just got myself into such a mess? I kept asking myself, why am I so stupid that I stooped this low to impress my so-called friends? They're not even here with me to help me out of this mess. My parents will probably never forgive me or ever trust me ever again. How could I do this to them? They've always given me everything I've ever wanted. After I finished signing some papers, they finally let me out. I didn't want to face my parents. When we headed toward the car, I walked behind my parents as slow as possible. When we got home, they gave me a really long lecture that made me cry the whole night. That night before I went to bed, I made a promise to myself that I will never steal anything else or do anything stupid like that ever again. Not only did I cause my parents pain, but I also threw away my own pride and good judgment trying to be someone I'm not.
Diary 36. Dear Diary, at first I asked Miss G, why should I read books about people that don't look like me? People that I don't even know and that I'm not going to understand because they don't understand me? I thought I was a smartass for asking her this question. I thought to myself, she's not going to give me an answer because this time I am right. She looked up and said very calmly, how can you say that? You haven't even bothered to open the front cover. Try it. You never know. The book may come to life before your eyes. So I started to read this book called Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, because I wanted to prove Miss G wrong. I wanted to show her that what she said was bullshit, and that her little technique was not going to work for me. I hate reading, and I hate her for that matter. To my surprise, I proved myself wrong because the book indeed came to life. At the end of the book, I was so mad that Anne died, because as she was dying, a part of me was dying with her. I cried when she cried, and just like her, I wanted to know why the Germans were killing her people. Just like her, I knew the feeling of discrimination and to be looked down upon based on the way you look. Just like her, I sometimes feel like a bird in a cage and just want to fly away. The first thing that came to my mind when I finished reading the book was the fact that Miss G was right. I did find myself within the pages of the book, like she said I would.
Diary 37. Dear Diary, I'm beginning to realize that Anne Frank, Zlata Filipovic, and I have a lot in common. We all seem to be trapped in some sort of a cage. Anne's cage was a secret annex that she and her family hid in, and the attic where she spent most of her time. Zlata's cage was the basement she had to use for shelter, away from bombs. My cage is my own house. Like Anne and Zlata, I have an enemy who is gung-ho for dictatorship, my father. He doesn't truly fit the role of a father in my perspective, so I refer to him as my sperm donor. James doesn't allow us to call him Dad or Father or any of those other sentimental lovey-dovey names. He says the titles aren't his name, so we can't call him that. Unfortunately, I can't relate with Anne Frank and Zlata Filipovic on the subject of their fathers. From what I've read, their fathers seem to really love them. I can, however, commiserate with them on the situations they were forced to endure. For example, I can easily put James in Hitler's shoes and our family in the roles of the Jews. Although not quite like the war Hitler started, the war in my house was also created by ignorance and stupidity. Like all wars, there is an enemy. There are innocent victims, destruction, senseless violence, displacement, and a winner and a loser. I've read about the monstrous things that were done in the concentration camps in World War II. I've read about how they would torture, starve, and mutilate people's bodies to something that was not recognizable as a human being. I watched my mother being beaten half to death by James, and watched as blood and tears streamed down her face, which was also unrecognizable. I felt useless and scared, furious at the same time, knowing that I could do nothing to help her. I watched him steal money from my mother's purse and sell our belongings for drugs. I'm sad to say he is the person I'm supposed to look up to for good, solid, fatherly advice. I can still feel the sting from the belt on my back and legs as he violently lashed me in his usual drunken state of mind. It's not likely that I'll be asking him for advice anytime soon. I can relate to Anne and Zlata. Like them, I have a diary. I write about how it feels to have disgust and hatred centered directly on you because of who you are. All I can do is wait for my mother to get rid of him. I'm surprised she hasn't already. She can be a strong woman if she puts her mind to it. I know that I will never let a man put his hands on me, won't ever tolerate that kind of abuse from anyone. I guess I'll have to wait for the war to end, like Anne and Zlata did, except I won't die or get taken advantage of. I'm going to be strong.
Diary 38. Dear Diary, we've been talking about the war in Bosnia and how similar some of the events are to the Holocaust. We have been reading about a young girl named Zlata, who many call the modern-day Anne Frank. Zlata and I seem to have a lot in common because while Zlata was living through a war in Sarajevo, I was living through a different kind of war, the L.A. riots. Ironically, Zlata and I were both 11 years old when our city was under siege. I can understand how afraid and scared she was to see her city go up in flames, because my city was on fire, too. The problem in Sarajevo began when a sniper fired a gun into a crowd at a peace rally. People panicked and war broke out. In Los Angeles, several policemen beat on a man named Rodney King and had to go to trial. The not guilty verdict caused people to go crazy. People started looting, fighting, and crashing cars into one another. Zlata and I both had to hide for our safety. This made us very frightened. Zlata was trapped in her basement while she heard bombs going off and people screaming. I was trapped inside my church while people were shooting, breaking windows, and screaming for their lives. Zlata and I lost our childhood innocence because we were denied the right to do childlike things, like go to school, talk on the phone, and just play outside. The buildings were burning and people got beaten up just because of the color of their skin, their religion, or ethnicity. Unfortunately, we both had to suffer because of other people's ignorance and destruction. Finally, the United Nations walked the streets of Bosnia trying to keep the peace. After days of chaos, the National Guard became the peacekeepers in L.A. Even though the United Nations and the National Guard were very successful at stopping the violence, the intolerance is still there. I can't believe that someone I don't even know, who lives thousands of miles away, could have so much in common with me.
Diary 39. Dear Diary, I don't understand. I mean, it's not right, yet it's still happening as we speak. I just can't believe it. How sick can it get? Why is it that women get molested? Why is it that people in general get molested? Peter Moss's article about Bosnia that we read today in Vanity Fair was like a gun that triggered the lost memory in my mind. Here are these women in Bosnia getting molested, raped, harassed, and even impregnated by soldiers that want to feel powerful by depriving them of their womanhood, pride, and self-esteem. Why? After reading the article about the atrocities in Bosnia, my memory returned and made everything seem like it happened yesterday. I was only 6 when a friend of my father's molested me in his home. Yet to this day, I haven't told my parents. Keeping this secret inside was very hard for me. There were times when I felt that I had to tell someone, but I didn't know who. Reading the article makes me feel like I'm not the only one who felt alone. Although I'm so many miles away from Bosnia, I wish there was something I could do. When I think about this, I think of how grateful Zlata and her whole family are because they have escaped from all of this. This very same thing could have happened to Zlata or any other person that would have remained behind. The mere fact that the story revived the lost memory within my mind gave me goosebumps. On the way home from school, I felt like reaching out to anyone that had a similar story. Even standing at the bus stop, I realized that the women and girls standing next to me may have been molested, harassed, or even impregnated at one point in their lives. Then there was the bus ride home. My mind was working like a shotgun, with every bullet acting as a question. Round 1, what if the elderly woman sitting across from me was sexually molested by her uncle when she was young? Round 2, How about that man standing in the back? Had he ever harassed a little girl? All of these questions ran through my mind at the thought of the story and of all the traumatizing things that women faced. I was glad in a way that Peter Moss had uncovered an issue that I believe we should all be aware of, and also to realize that we are not alone. His story was written to expose the war in Bosnia and its similarity to the Holocaust. Knowing that people are getting murdered and that thousands of women were being raped is shocking. It makes me both sad and angry because history is indeed repeating itself.
Diary 40. Dear Diary, I joined Ms. Gruel's class a few days ago. I don't know if I should have joined in the middle of the year. Oh, well, I'll just have to try to keep up with whatever they'll be discussing in the class. So far, all I've heard about is a girl named Zlata. I was clueless about who she was when I started this class, so I asked my friend Anna who Zlata was. Wait here, she told me. Anna searched through a box located behind Miss Gruel's desk. She quickly brought back a book entitled Zlata's Diary, A Child's Life in Sarajevo. She handed the book to me to read. I still tried to keep up with the class discussions that were usually concentrated on Zlata. The class talked about her like they knew her, like they knew what she went through while she was in the middle of the war. But how could they know? They've never been in the middle of a war. Or so I thought. I learned a lot in the first few days that I was enrolled in the class. Some of my classmates are going through a war, an undeclared war, waged on innocent kids just trying to grow up. Society just doesn't care about young people anymore, even if we are the future. Now that I've finished the book, I began to understand the class discussions. As one of our assignments, the class had to write letters inviting Zlata to come to Long Beach. Many of the students, including myself, did the assignment thinking it was just an assignment. But when one student asked Ms. Gruel if Zlata was really going to come, Ms. Gruel had a gleam in her eye. I don't think that it was her intention to actually send a letter to Zlata, but now that the idea was brought up, why not? For the first time, I heard a teacher take a question seriously. She really wanted to fly Zlata over to the United States to meet our class. Where were we going to get the money? Where in the world would she stay? There was no way we could do this. But Ms. Gruel asked, "When have I let you down?" I began to write a warm invitation and jazzed it up with graphics. I still wasn't sure if Ms. Gruel was serious. After the phrase, "When have I let you down?" ran through my mind several times, I began to hope that Zlata really would come to meet us. But for now, all I and the rest of our classmates could do was keep writing and keep our fingers crossed.
Sophomore year, spring 1996.
Dear Zlata, they say America is the land of the free and the home of the brave. But what's so free about a land where people get killed? My name is Thomas Tommy Jefferson from Wilson High School in Long Beach, California. I am a 15-year-old teenage boy whose life seems to be similar to yours. In your diary, you said you watched out for snipers and gunshots. I watch out for gangsters and gunshots. Your friends died of gunshots, and my friend Richard, who was 15, and my cousin Matthew, who was 19, also died of gunshots. The strange thing is, my country is not in a war. Or is it? My close friend Richard was shot in the heart by a carjacker who was trying to steal his mom's car. He died in his mom's arms. His final words were, "I love you." He died on December 8, 1995, just a couple weeks before Christmas. When I saw her at Christmas, I didn't even know what to say. What could I say to a mother whose son just died? My cousin Matthew was shot 5 times in the head by a Mexican gang on February 8, 1996. Matthew was simply walking home when a van full of gangsters pulled him into their car, drove him down to the railroad tracks, beat him up, and then shot him repeatedly in the head. I hurt. It's painful when I think about his death. 2 people who I cared about died a senseless death exactly 2 months apart. Neither of their deaths was recognized in the papers. Why? Doesn't anyone care? I care. Their families care also, but now their mothers are scarred for life because they'll never hear or see their sons again. Sometimes I want to take a gun and get revenge, but what would that prove? Would it prove how much I cared about them? Would it prove that I stuck up for them? No. The only thing it would prove is how dumb I am. And I am not dumb. The main reason I'm writing this letter to you, Zlata, is because I know you've been in this kind of situation. Your experience moved me and made this big football player cry, and I usually don't cry. So please tell me, Zlata, how should I handle a tragedy like this? Now that I've read your book, I am educated on what is happening in Bosnia. I would like the opportunity now to educate people on what is happening in my America, because until this undeclared war has ended, I am not free. Your friend, Tommy Jefferson.
Entry 4, Ms. Grunewell. Dear Diary, after our toast for change, my students experienced an epiphany. My once apathetic students seemed to transform themselves into scholars with a conscience. They were so motivated that it's awe-inspiring. And when Tommy told me he was done with all the books in our readathon for tolerance, I almost spit out my morning coffee. "Tommy, you're done already?" I asked. "Yeah, well, I've been grounded for the last 2 weeks, so all I did was read." Read? Wait a minute. Is this the same Tommy who used to hate reading? Tommy was a disciplinary transfer like Sherrod. He had been transferred into my class mid-semester as a favor to our vice principal. Apparently, his last English teacher was afraid of him. Actually, I was too at first. But when he asked for more books, I couldn't help but give him a hug. Then I called his father. It was the first time I called a parent to report good news. Obviously, it was the first time Tommy's father ever received such a call, because he began the conversation with, "Okay, what did Tommy do this time?" He was pretty surprised to hear that Tommy was my star pupil. And Tommy's not alone. Grounded or not, they've all become voracious readers. They even carry around the plastic Barnes & Noble bags to show off their new books. They call it flossing. I call it a miracle. Their excitement has motivated me even more. I wanted to put a face on the genocide in Bosnia. Without really thinking about the logistics, I foolishly suggested that we write letters to Zlata and invite her to our class. It was a ploy to get them to write letters, but I didn't think they'd take me so seriously. I underestimated the power of suggestion. Some of them truly believed that if they wrote to her, she would come, as if it were a self-fulfilling prophecy. Their letters were so compelling that I took them to the school's computer lab to type. Then I had them bound into a book at Kinko's. I put Tommy's letter near the top because he drew parallels between the war in Bosnia and the senseless gang violence. His letter began, "They say America is the land of the free and home of the brave. But what's so free about a land where people get killed?" Despite being on the other side of the world, he pointed out similarities between their lives. In Sarajevo, innocent kids get shot by snipers. In Long Beach, they get shot in drive-bys. Zlata's friend Nina was killed by shrapnel. Tommy's best friend was murdered. He ended his letter by stating, "Now that I've read your book, I am educated on what is happening in Bosnia. I would like the opportunity now to educate people on what is happening in my America, because until this undeclared war has ended, I am not free." War? In America? It was sad to think that kids like Tommy feel like they live in the middle of a war zone. War is not something I think of as a domestic problem. I read about wars in the newspaper and watch reports on the evening news. I naively assumed that war occurred in far-off places with hard-to-pronounce names, not in Long Beach. Whether it's declared or not, there is a war being fought on the street corners and alleyways of Long Beach. And even though there aren't tanks rolling down the streets, there are Uzis, semi-automatics, and other weapons of war. One student even said, "Gangs don't die, Ms. G. They multiply." As if there was no solution in sight. A casualty of war, be it at the hands of a Nazi soldier, a sniper in Sarajevo, or a gangbanger on the streets of America, is a universal tragedy. After one student hopelessly said, "Zlata survived her war, but I'm afraid I may not survive mine," I was convinced that Zlata must read their letters. Once that realization sunk in, I began to panic. I had no idea where to send the letters. In fact, I had no idea where Zlata lived, if she spoke English, or how much it would cost to bring her here. There was so much I didn't know. Would we have to bring her parents, a translator, or an entourage? In a feeble attempt to squelch the idea of inviting her, I put the onus back on them. "If you want her to come, then you have to raise the money to get her here." Nice try, but that didn't stop them. The next day, a student brought in an empty Sparklets water jug and set it in the middle of the classroom. He announced, "We need to start collecting money for Zlata." And then he dropped in a few coins. He was so serious that I didn't have the heart to tell him that we probably needed to fill a couple of those jugs just to pay for one airline ticket. A couple of days later, when the bottom of the jug was filled with coins and a few loose dollar bills, he asked, "Ms. Gruwell, what happens if we raise all this money and Zlata doesn't come?" I'm used to them putting me on the spot, but I wasn't prepared for this one. Trying to be fast on my feet, I said, "If she doesn't come, we can buy more books or go on another field trip. But if she does come, your lives will never be the same." And then it hit me. I better find her and at least send her the letters. If she doesn't respond, at least we tried. So I spent the entire Christmas vacation trying to track Zlata down. I had no idea where to start. All I knew was that she was a refugee somewhere in Europe. I started at the Museum of Tolerance. They thought she might be living in France. Then Renee Firestone told me she thought she had moved to Ireland. To play it safe, I sent a package to both countries. Then I put my concierge skills to the test. I got quotes on airline tickets, solicited local restaurants to donate gift certificates, and my hotel even offered two rooms if she accepted our invitation. With all the provisions in order, all we had to do now was wait. While anxiously awaiting a response from Zlata, a wonderful woman named Gerda Seifer, a Holocaust survivor from Poland, called to tell me that Miep Gies was actually coming to California to help commemorate the 50th anniversary of Anne Frank's diary. Miep was Otto Frank's secretary and the person responsible for finding Anne's diary. She's 87 years old and will be flying in from Amsterdam. The director of the event happened to live near me. We met and hit it off. He offered to change Meep's itinerary so she could come meet my students. Wow! Meeting a legend like Miep is more than we could have ever hoped for. To help prepare the students for Miep's visit, I asked Gerda to share her experience during World War II with the students. Like Anne, who spent her adolescence in hiding in the secret annex, Gerda sat perched on a wooden box in a windowless cellar. Not only will the students be able to empathize with Gerda's feelings of persecution and loss, but I hope they'll be able to understand how Anne Frank must have felt.
Diary 41. Dear Diary, when we began our lesson about the importance of racial tolerance, I had no idea that that lesson would be a life-altering experience. After reading Night and Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, I guess you could say I knew about the Holocaust, but I was not prepared for what I was going to be faced with today. Ms. Gruel had been talking for a long time about bringing in a Holocaust survivor named Gerda Seifer. Well, today, we actually met her. Like Anne, she is Jewish and was born in Poland, and she didn't meet Hitler's standards of purity either. During World War II, Gerda's parents made her go into hiding with a Catholic family. She was forced to live in a basement where she could barely stand up. She could hear the SS soldiers marching outside, waiting for their next victim. She's the only survivor in her family. Luckily, she was spared from a camp. Just as Anne was trapped, Gerda was trapped. Neither Gerda nor Anne could lead normal teenage lives. They lost their innocence due to uncontrollable circumstances. Whenever they ventured outdoors, they faced the possibility of being captured by the Gestapo. Jewish people had to wear a yellow Star of David, which distinguished them from others. They were forced to attend special schools isolated from other children. They were ridiculed and tormented throughout the war. Unfortunately, I know exactly what it feels like to not be able to go outside, not because of the Gestapo, but because of gangs. When I walk outside, I constantly glance from side to side, watching those standing around me. Since I feel out of place, I often put on a facade so that I fit in. Maybe if I look and act like I belong, they will not confront me. It is disrespectful to look a gang member in the eye. Imagine what would happen if a prisoner in a concentration camp insulted a Gestapo. They would get killed instantly. After the stories I had heard from Gerda, I can guarantee that I won't repeat the mistakes of others. It amazed me how I could empathize not only with Anne Frank, but also with the Holocaust survivor. I'm glad I had the opportunity to hear about the past through Gerda. She is living proof of history. This experience will help me pass on the message of tolerance that Anne died for and that Gerda survived for.
Diary 42. Dear Diary, to a 15-year-old, the only heroes I ever read about ran around in tight, colorful underwear and threw buildings at each other for fun. But today, that all changed. A true hero leapt off the pages of a book to pay my class a special visit. Her name is Meep Geese, and she is the lady Anne Frank wrote about in her diary. I can't believe that the woman responsible for keeping Anne Frank alive in the attic came to speak to us in person. As I entered the Bruin Den Teen Center, I could feel the excitement. Many of us stayed after school yesterday to make welcome signs, to decorate the walls, and several students got to school really early to help set up a big buffet. We wanted everything to be perfect. After the proper introductions were made by Ms. Gruel, she made her entrance. Everybody stood up and cheered as Meep made her way into the hall. I was thrilled to see her in person after seeing her portrayed in movies and reading about her in the book. No colorful underwear needed. She was a true hero. After she settled in, Meep began to talk about how she was delighted to meet us. She described to us firsthand how she hid the Frank family from the Nazi soldiers and how she found Anne's diary. When she described how the Gestapo captured Anne and would not allow Meep to say goodbye, it made all of us emotional. She told us about how she tried to bribe the officers into letting her friends go, but they threatened to kill her. My friend who was sitting next to me was crying. Since we've been studying the Holocaust, it has made him think about all the people he knows who have been killed. His best friend accidentally shot himself, and to this day he still has nightmares about his death. Meep told everyone that not a day goes by where she doesn't think about Anne. When she said this, my friend stood up and told her she was his hero. Then he asked her if she believed that she was a hero. We expected her to say yes, but I think she surprised us all. She said no. You, my friends, are the true heroes. Heroes? Us? Having her say that made me realize more than ever how special my classmates are. Like she said, we are the heroes, and it is up to us to let the younger generation know what's going on. It sure feels good to know that for once in my life, my friends and I are doing the right thing. After she finished and we all had the opportunity to give her a hug or have her sign our books, I realized how lucky we were. Most people will probably never have the opportunity to hear her story in person like we did. A legacy left by one girl, carried by one woman, was passed on to a new generation of teens who have the chance to make a difference like Anne's diary did. Now, after meeting Meep, I can honestly say that my heroes are not just made-up characters. My hero is real.
Diary 43. Dear Diary, if you could live in eternity and not change a thing, or exist for the blink of an eye and alter everything, what would you choose? This was one of Miss G's questions after we read this poem. Moment. Let him wish his life for the sorrows of a stone, never knowing the first thread of these, never knowing the pain of ice, as its crystals slowly grow, needles pressing in on the heart. To live forever and never feel a thing, to wait a million lifetimes only to erode and become sand. Wish not for the stone, but for the fire. Last only moments, but change everything. Oh, to be lightning, to exist for less than a moment, yet in that moment, to expose the world to every open eye. Oh, to be thunder, to clap and ring, to rumble into memories, minds and spines, to chill the soul and shake the very ground, pounding even the sand into smaller pieces, or the mountain brooding, extinct, yet gathering for one fatal moment the power to blow the top clean off the world. Oh, to last the blink of an eye and leave nothing but nothing unmoved behind you. Vincent Giuliano, January 9th, 1991. Miss G gave us this poem, written by someone who had gone to college with her. Ironically, he died shortly after he wrote the poem by drowning in the San Francisco Bay. After we read the poem, Miss G broke it down to its simplest form. She wanted no part to be misunderstood. She wanted this poem to become our motto in class and our principle in life. She told us to be the kind of people that have enough passion to change the world. If we let ourselves be fire, thunder, or lightning, we could alter everything. We all thought that Miss Gruelle's lesson was really powerful and all, but us, lightning and thunder? Not likely. The below-average, sure-to-drop-out kids? Please, ever since I can remember, we've been put down and stepped on, and now all of a sudden we have the potential to change the world? Leave it up to Miss Gruelle to come up with some crazy shit like that. She tried to convince us that we were capable of anything. But it wasn't until Meep's visit that it finally made sense. I remember talking about how much we admired her for risking everything to care for Anne and her family. She said that she had only done it because it was the right thing to do. Someone stood up and said that Meep was their hero. No, you're the real heroes, she answered. There she was, one of the most heroic women of all time, telling us that we were heroes. Do not let Anne's death be in vain, Meep said, using her words to bring it all together. Meep wanted us to keep Anne's message alive. It was up to us to remember it. Meep and Miss Gruelle had had the same purpose all along. They wanted us to seize the moment. Miss Gruelle wanted us to realize that we could change the way things were. And Meep wanted to take Anne's message and share it with the world. That's when it all became crystal clear. Anne's message of tolerance was to become our message. At that moment, I became like the fire, and like the lightning, and like thunder.
Diary 44. Dear Diary, I can't believe that Zlata Filipovic is coming. Our letters actually paid off. After reading her book, I couldn't do anything but relate her life with mine. It was so interesting to realize that another person my same age went through such a horrible experience seeking refuge from a war. Even though I didn't physically experience a war, my family managed to escape one just in time from Nicaragua. Blasts of gunfire thundered throughout my country, too. I can candidly say that in the back of my mind, I didn't think Zlata would actually respond to our invitation. I felt like we were writing to a celebrity, and all we would end up hearing in return was a letter from her agent saying thank you and here's a signed photograph. Zlata's response, on the other hand, was much more gratifying. Not only did she personally write back to us, but she also mentioned that she would be more than happy to meet us. I feel like I'm about to meet a person whom I could relate to.
Diary 45. Dear Diary, March 24th, 1996 was the most unforgettable day ever. I had the pleasure of going with my family to the Newport Beach Marriott Hotel to meet Zlata Filipovic and her parents, Malik and Alicia, and her best friend Mirna. My parents got dressed up in their nicest clothes for the occasion. I wore a suit. We drove to the hotel, not knowing what to expect from the evening. As soon as we walked inside the Marriott Hotel, we felt important and excited to be there. A photographer took our pictures, and waiters in tuxedos and white gloves served us appetizers off silver trays. They even served us punch and champagne glasses. Since Ms. Gruel works there, she made sure that everyone went out of their way to treat us like royalty. When Zlata came down to meet us, all of us surrounded her as if she was a celebrity. We all wanted to take pictures with her and ask her questions about herself. It was so interesting to see how we had a girl our own age that is such a role model to us. The fact that she was actually here was so unbelievable. I found out we had a lot in common. We both liked listening to music and being with our friends. Zlata left such a good first impression that I'll never forget her. As we continued to celebrate, we had a formal dinner in her honor. The food was delicious. There must have been at least 5 courses. There were so many knives and forks at our table, I'm glad Ms. Gruel went over which ones we're supposed to use first. Before the night was over, Ms. Gruel told us that this was just the beginning and there's more to come. I left the Marriott with a good feeling and high expectations about our future.
Diary 46. Dear Diary, my friendship with Mary reminds me of Zlata and Mirna's friendship. They have been through a war together because of race and religion, and they are still best friends. The only difference is that neither of their families want to prevent their friendship. There's not even a war in this country, yet I can't even go to a movie with my friend because she's white. Why does that matter anymore? I thought we were in a new era and were getting over the race issue. Yeah, right. I'm living in a big fantasy world. The time hasn't come for people to overcome hatred of others because of something as insignificant as race. She's the best friend a person could ever have. She's fun, smart. She doesn't just hear me, she listens to me.